On today's episode of the podcast, I chat to Dr. Adam Collins, Head of Nutrition at Surrey University, who has a special interest in intermittent fasting and time-restricted eating. He has personally conducted research into this field. I contacted him to get his reaction on the controversial study that suggested that intermittent fasting can raise your risk of dying from cardiovascular disease by 91%. In this conversation, we break down exactly how this study was conducted. We go through the hierarchy of nutritional studies and exactly where this one lies, as well as a whole host of other problems with this study. How do you create a life that allows you to lose weight, eat the foods that you love, and sustain the results? Over the last 10 years, I've helped thousands of people do exactly that. I'm Max Lowry. I'm an author, personal trainer, and weight loss coach. In this podcast, I'm going to share my top tips and tricks from within my one-on-one coaching program. It's my goal to give you the tools and understanding so that you never diet again. So firstly, you explain who you are and why you're interested in intermittent fasting.
Okay, so I'm Dr. Adam Collins. I'm an associate professor of nutrition at Surrey. I've had a long-standing interest in intermittent fasting, done research on intermittent fasting, continue to be looking at that area of research with my current PhD students and other projects that are going on. And that covers various aspects of intermittent fasting, from your sort of traditional 5-2 approach, which was early studies, to now more nuanced approaches, which incorporate things like time-restricted eating, but also macronutrient manipulation that could give you similar effects of fasting. So whether you call that fast mimicking or whatever. So there is lots of things aligned to intermittent fasting and the types of research that I do. If that satisfies that question.
Yeah, it's perfect. To summarize, what is your professional opinion on intermittent fasting and time-restricted eating? Is it something that is useful and safe?
So if you're thinking of time-restricted eating specifically, so intermittent fasting obviously covers a whole range of different interventions that stem from your 5-2 alternate day fasting to maybe extended fasted periods of, say, maybe several days that you do once a month. So lots of different modes of fasting. And of course, time-restricted eating is one of those where you're incorporating an extended fast within a 24-hour period. So you're shortening an eating window to extend the period of not eating, usually restricting that to less than 12 hours, typically around 8 hours of eating, and then up to 16 hours of not eating. The idea being that you're allowing your body to spend more time in a truly fasted state than you would do ordinarily. And that's because normally people's eating window are more than 12 hours and sometimes approaching 16 hours. It's almost like the reverse. And when you think of it like that, then from a metabolic point of view, people are not even in a fasted state at all, let alone only for a short period of time. So this is a way in which you're allowing that to happen. So that's the time-restricted eating. Now, in terms of an intervention, it is the most user-friendly one, I suppose, because it is something that isn't a severe restriction for, say, 36 hours, like a 5-2 or an alternate day fast. And you are allowing, obviously, normal eating. You're not technically restricting how much they're eating. It's just you're changing the timing or the meal pattern that diet is. So that makes it a bit more universally acceptable as a form of intermittent fasting, and that's why it's got quite a lot of popularity now. because it can be applied to a broad range of people, not just people that want to lose weight ultimately, because that's really the one of the key results of something like an extended fast or alternate day fasting in a 5-2, because you're basically creating an overall energy deficit. So yeah, that's where time restricted eating comes in as a mode.
And this study is specifically talking about time restricted eating, isn't it? The 16-8.
Yes, but it is and it isn't. Time restricted eating is, as an intervention, however you do it, and different interventions vary, but typically you are reducing the eating window. And now 16-8 is one regimented way in which you're doing it, because you're doing 8 hours of eating and 16 hours of not eating. But however you're intervening, time-restricted eating is about shifting that eating window, reducing that eating window to extend that fasted period or period of not eating. And some people do that symmetrically, so they might reduce that eating window by bringing breakfast later and dinner earlier. Some people shift it to an early form of time-restricted eating, where you're eating earlier in the day and then stopping eating earlier, or a late time-restricted feeding, where perhaps you're delaying your breakfast in terms of that first meal, and then eating up to the normal pattern of eating in the evening. Generally, the consensus seems to be that early time-restricted eating performs slightly better than late time restricted for eating, but there are effects of either way of doing it. Whatever you do in terms of eating that window, you do get some beneficial effects. Now, some of that is actually creating some loss of intake, because some people actually end up eating less and lose a bit of weight. So that's often an outcome of these time-restricted eating. As soon as you start restricting, not necessarily telling them to restrict what they're eating, but just restricting the time or availability that they've got, then, yes, some people eat to the clock and cram everything into that eating window, but other people will either intentionally or unintentionally end up eating less. Some of them might choose to skip a meal altogether. So they might skip breakfast or they might skip dinner as a way of basically enforcing a time-restricted eating window. It depends.
It makes sense. You restrict the time in which you can consume calories, most people end up eating less. And that's really why I think, as you said, it can be quite universally available, is because it makes eating less much easier. Before we go into any more about intermittent fasting, the reason we're having this conversation is because of this study that's come out. And I'll summarize what the headline said. And it basically said eating 16-8 specifically can increase the risk of cardiovascular disease by 91%. What is your initial reaction to this?
Well, let's unpick that a little bit. So it's saying that it's increasing the likelihood of mortality from cardiovascular disease. So people dying of cardiovascular disease. Now that is quite a scary headline to say, because it's almost like saying it's going to cause you to die prematurely or die of cardiovascular disease.
It's very extreme.
Which is extreme. And obviously that hits the headlines. But we need to obviously unpick this a bit, because what they're looking at is basically two sets of data, or like marrying two sets of data together. So one is mortality statistics, so things where they have looked at death rates in a proportion of people, and those subset of the population that they're using is a subset of the NAHANE study. So the NAHANE study is a national nutrition survey that's been rolling since the 1970s in the States, where you're trying to take stock of what people are eating as a population. So they've got this data, this rolling data on intake, and they're trying to then marry that to the mortality statistics that they've got. So they've chosen 20,000 people, which they've followed over a period of time, or they got data that has followed them over, they say it's like a median of around 8 years, but somewhere between like 5 and 20 years. I think the maximum is about 17 years that they followed them. And of course, what they're interested in is over that period of time where they were looking at them, how many of them died of cardiovascular disease? I think the average age was around 40, so they're in their late 40s, typically. Mm. So they are in that sort of chance alley where, you know, if you're going to get cardiovascular disease and die of heart attack or something, it's going to happen probably in that period between the ages of late 40s into 60, by the time you get to a sort of retirement age. If you're going to die prematurely, that's the sort of time when it's going to happen. So from that point of view, I can see the sort of sense of doing it. But then what they're trying to say is, okay, well, they've got this mortality data, and then they're going to sort of say, okay, of these 20,000 people, of which we've got a proportion are going to die. Not all of them are going to die, of course. You know, some, only a small proportion are going to die by the time they've stopped looking at them. And then they're going to say, well, okay, if there's 20,000 people, I'm going to subdivide them into those that have a short eating window and those that have a normal eating window. So what I'm saying is that this is not looking at people that have been told to follow a time-restricted eating regime, and then they're followed for 8 years and 17 years and see whether they're going to die prematurely. It's trying to back extrapolate from that mortality data whether there is a difference in the risk ratio, yeah, the likelihood of that person dying, if their eating window was either less than 8 hours, or I think it was less than 12 hours was their cutoff, or more than 12 hours. So that's not cause and effect. That's just looking at observational data between two subsets within a subset itself. So that's one thing to say. And then the other thing to say is that, let's say that you're following these people over time on average about 8 years. What you're assuming, first of all, is that you're defining them having time-restricted eating or following time-restricted eating based on some look at their diet. Now, so you're saying, okay, what is their diet intake? And what is their eating window based on that observation of their intake? And that's based on 2 days, two 24-hour recalls. So they've asked them on two occasions what they ate the previous day from when they woke up to when they went to bed. And then they've obviously got timings of that as well within that data to work out what the eating window is in these people. So what was the time in their first meal? What was the time in their last meal to give them that eating window? But that's just based on 2 days of recall.
2 days.
2 days of recall.
Yeah, so they have to think back and remember what they're eating on certain days.
As if I asked you, so I'm going to ask you everything you ate and drank yesterday. And then you're going to work through, and it is a standardized way of doing it. This is a bona fide method of dietary assessment, which is quite useful for populations because you can phone people up and basically do an interview over the phone and follow a script, which is basically saying, when you wake up, what do you have? And you can follow sort of a pattern. As an interviewer, you follow a sort of formula of questions. But essentially, it's reliant on their memory. And of course, it's only giving you a snapshot of 2 days, random days. But also, those 2 days are within the first year of that follow-up. So you're not looking at that over time. So you've not got any idea as to whether not only is those 2 days that you've got representative of all the days of their intake at that point in time, But certainly you've got no idea whether they carried on doing that type of intake for 8 years or however long that you're following up from, because they could have changed their diet the next day. You wouldn't have a clue. And it's not saying that they're doing this to follow time-restricted eating, because you're sort of cross-referencing that to time-restricted eating, because you, by definition, are calling it time-restricted eating. When it's not deliberate time-restricted eating, it just happens to be an eating window that's less than 12 hours. I mean, some of them might be deliberate time-restricted eating, but my sense is it's unlikely, because you're looking at retrospective data. You know, this, you're looking at data 8 years ago. You know, how many people in the US in their 40s 8 years ago are likely to be doing deliberate time-restricted eating? Probably not that many. So how can you turn that into something that's criticizing that as an intervention?
And it's interesting you say that, actually, because now over the past kind of 5 years, I've had hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of one-on-one conversations with people who are struggling with their weight. And a high percentage of them are accidentally skipping breakfast. And it's unintentional. And then that actually leads to part of the problem with their weight. There's no structure, there's no routine. It leads to binge eating in the evenings, and they've got a lot of weight to lose. It's interesting you say that.
Yeah, because it's and that erratic eating or unstructured eating might be for various reasons. It could be because they're deliberately trying to do that as a method of trying to lose weight. Or they're doing it because they believe it's better for them. Or it could be that just their diet and lifestyle is conducive to that erratic pattern of eating. So, which obviously brings into play lots of other things that obviously can affect cardiovascular risk. Not just the timing of their eating or the fact they've deliberately, which they haven't done, chosen to restrict their eating window to less than 12 hours. So, absolutely. I mean, this is the thing. I mean, it's difficult to unpick it fully because, of course, this is, don't forget, a conference paper. Right? So it's an abstract presented at a conference. So we don't have the true methodology. We're sort of piecing this together from basically a one page, one side of A4
ADF,
description of the study that's presented at a conference. And normally, when you're presenting something in a conference, it's either a precursor to a paper that you're going to present or publish, or it could be that you're just looking at something that is not robust enough to actually publish as a full paper. So it could be some pilot data, or it could be a speculative piece of work, or it could just be something of interest that they've unearthed through some examination of stuff. So now, it's amazing how something like this has been picked up, because usually things that are presented in conferences just, don't get to see the light of day outside that conference. But because this is such a exciting headline, the headline is one that's just piques everyone's interest, that obviously it's got a lot of attention.
What do you think the researchers involved had any idea that it would get this much press? And do you think that they would be concerned that it is being interpreted by the press in this way?
That's an interesting question. Don't know. And the reason why I think they must have an inkling as to this is obviously going to be of interest. Otherwise, they wouldn't have presented it in that way. So I don't think you can argue that it's just their naivety, where they didn't really expect this to be picked up and gone viral. I'm sure they didn't think it was going to go viral. But I'm sure, like any researcher, you know, you want to present something that is topical and it is it's going to be of interest, or it's, you want to put something out there that in a way makes a bit of a name for yourself, but you're not doing it for that, but you're putting something out there that perhaps changes people's perspective a little bit, or gets people to think, or is a discussion point, which is great. I mean, that's what conferences should be about. I mean, often you're presenting ideas and you're discussing things around you amongst your peers in that sort of forum, and hopefully that would then spawn lots of other types of research or further study, even if it's not something that is, you know, either designed in a robust way that you can publish it, or has not enough data to have statistical power to show definitively this thing, but it's like a hypothesis generating thing.
Yeah.
So you're sort of asking a question and saying, well, this, maybe there's something going on, maybe there's something related to this, and it could be to do with time restricted eating, or it could be all manner of other things that are confounders to that outcome. You know, that could be explaining the fact that they've got a higher mortality rate now, because we don't know what the characteristics of those two groups are. You know, so when they split them into plus 12 hours, minus 12 hour window, it could be that those plus 12 hours were younger, had lower risk to start with than the ones that had less than 12 hours. Yeah, so that you're not starting with a comparable base. And of course, you don't know what other exposures those two groups had, which might be different, whether that's a diet, whether that's a lifestyle, whether it's, you know, a higher proportion of people that are smoking or other things.
Drinking, drugs, exercise.
Yeah. Or it could be that, you know, maybe those people in the other group died of other reasons rather than cardiovascular disease. Yeah, maybe they had more cancer, more Alzheimer's, more dementia, which is another leading cause, which could be vascular caused as well. Mm. But, you know, so it just, in a way, poses more questions than answers it. So it's quite a nice question and hypothesis generator, it doesn't come with any explanation.
No. Yeah,
because there is, and what is the mechanism? And this is the question that was sort of posed when it went out to us. You know, what is the mechanism? Why would it cause people to die of cardiovascular disease or increase their cardiovascular risk? And there isn't really any mechanism specifically that time-restricted eating would do that, you know, directly. But there might be indirect effects of following a time-restricted eating pattern, because it might have knock-on behavioural effects, or other things might change as a consequence to the negative. But in terms of the mechanistic basis of doing time-restricted eating in the first place, if anything, that should be cardioprotective rather than increasing your risk of cardiovascular disease. But again, it depends how you follow it, isn't it? So it's like any other intervention. You can do it well, or you can do it badly. Are you frozen there, Max? Are you back? Did you hear that?
I missed, the last thing I heard was cardioprotective.
Yeah, so the time-restricted eating, the rationale behind it is linked to being more cardioprotective rather than damaging, because it's designed to have an effect in terms of reducing cardiovascular risk or cardiometabolic risk. But what I was then went on to say is that, but it depends how you do that intervention, because the selling point of time-restricted eating is it's an easy thing that you're imposing on people. You say, right, okay, just eat within an 8-hour window, or restrict your eating window by this amount, either side or early, late, but you're not instructing them how to follow that. So it could be that people follow it in a very different way, or, you know, they just gorge on rubbish during that period, so the nutrient quality is terrible, even though they're in a time-restricted eating pattern.
So in that context, the issue isn't the time-restricted eating, is the fact that they're gorging potentially on ultra-processed foods.
It could be anything. I mean, you could argue it anyway. I mean, unless you actually look at it, I mean, this is the difference between this study, which is just an observation and an assumption that this is time-restricted eating, as opposed to looking at an actual controlled intervention and seeing what happens. Which, admittedly, you would never really do in practice, because what they're looking at is something that you could never do, because you just haven't got resources and it just wouldn't be practical. You wouldn't put people on time-restricted eating, get them to follow it for 8 years on average, and then see whether they died or not. I mean, you just wouldn't do it. But again, that is the difference between something that is extrapolated from epidemiology data, so looking at populations and risks and outcomes, as opposed to a proper longitudinal study or intervention study where you're not just recruiting people, but you're controlling the intervention and you're following them over a period of time.
So on that note, very briefly, could you describe the hierarchy of nutritional studies just for people who are listening who don't understand? What's kind of the gold standard of a nutritional study? What's beneath that? What's the bottom? And where does this one lie?
Yeah, well, it's an interesting one, this sort of hierarchy of evidence. I mean, people have started to debate that. But if you look at that as a pyramid, then often people put, for example, randomized controlled trials as being quite near the top. So that's where you look at an intervention against a comparison. So whether that's sort of the classic example is like a drug versus placebo trial. You get people to follow a drug and then you see how that affects them compared to no drug or placebo. And that's sort of held up as, in terms of an intervention study, like the gold standard. That's very difficult to do from a dietary point of view because, you know, food is not a drug, diet is not a drug. So there's lots of other things that change as soon as you start to intervene with a diet. But nonetheless, you could think of that randomized controlled trial as a higher quality of evidence. Then you've got sort of case control type studies where you look at those that are exposed versus those that are not exposed. And you could argue that, is this a case control study? Not really, because you're not really as certain that those people are exposed. So it's like saying, looking at people that have this disease versus people that don't have that disease, for example, which is not the case here, because you're assuming that this is time-restricted eating and this isn't time-restricted eating. So that's obviously what we talked about in terms of criticism. Then you've got sort of epidemiological studies, so association studies. So you might plot in a population whether there's an association between X and Y. So that could be cardiovascular mortality and salt intake, or it could be risk of dementia and number of hours watching social media. It could be anything. It could plot any two things against each other. And that sort of gives you an association. It's not cause and effect, but it might, again, generate hypothesis to say, you know, why are these two things associated? What's going on that might link these two things together, or what might cause one to cause the other? So often what you're doing is working through these layers, because to build evidence, you might start with something that's hypothesis generating, which might even be a individual case study, or something that you observe anecdotally in practice. And then you might then see, well, what's the association between these two things from an epidemiological point of view? Then how would I test maybe mechanistically those that are exposed versus those that aren't exposed? And then I might do some sort of case control study where I might actually look at some mechanistic effect, my acute effect of that, in a short term, very controlled way. And then I might roll that out as an intervention to see, as an intervention, is that going to be effective versus a comparable intervention or nothing. And then I suppose what is often put right at the top of the pyramid is like systematic reviews and meta-analysis, which is basically saying, I'm going to take all of the studies that have been done, all of those in RCTs, and put them together to come up with a consensus of effect. And that's often put right at the top of the pyramid. But that, but all of these things are relatively subjective. But so if you take a systematic review or meta-analysis, that essentially is subjective, because I can choose the studies that I want to choose to put in that meta-analysis to show an effect or not an effect, or prove a hypothesis or not. And that's often been the case, particularly around things like saturated fat and cardiovascular disease, or carbohydrates versus fat. Yeah, that's been manipulated such that you're almost like choosing your selection criteria to fit the narrative that you want. So I wouldn't say that that is, yes, in theory, that would be atop your pyramid, because you're not just looking at one study in isolation, you're looking at a consensus of studies that are comparable to each other. But again, you've got to be careful of bias. So in answer to your question in terms of hierarchy of evidence, yes, that hierarchy of evidence you could lay out, but if you really wanted to know, you need to look at all of the evidence across all those different tiers to find out what's going on, because you might need to think about a hypothesis initially, which might come from an observation anecdotally or clinical case study. You might then look at also what happens in the population at the same time to see what associations are going on. Then you need to obviously think about how that makes sense with your understanding of the mechanism. So is there a case to be made, you know, scientifically, why these two things would be linked together? What might explain A be equaling B, or X related to Y? So do you need to have a bit of understanding of the science behind it, which often people don't have, to actually try and work out, is there a mechanistic link, or what could be causing this, which then should inform some form of study to test that mechanistic effect, which then might lead to an intervention versus a control or a case control study to investigate that further. And then you do enough of those independently of each other to see whether there's a consensus going on. And this is obviously happening over a long period of time.
And it sounds like this study in question is actually even below the three that you've mentioned, because really, as you said, it's self-reported data. They're assuming there's that people were doing time restricted eating based off 2 days. And then correlating that with who died or not.
So it's a question generating study, if you call it a study. I mean, it's just an observation. That's all it is. So you're observing. To some extent, it is like a case control, because you are essentially saying your cases are your time restricted eating and your controls are normal eating. But of course, you can criticize how they've done that, because it's not really a true case control. It's just an observation. It's an association study which could generate a hypothesis which needs to be explored. And there could be bona fide reasons why time restricted eating could lead to cardiovascular risk. But we need to explore that. You know, we need to either suggest what the mechanism is that might do that does that. And again, I don't think that's an obvious one, given what we understand at the moment. But we also need to observe that and, you know, triangulate that. I mean, that's what you're trying to do all the time. You're not just taking one bit of evidence out of context, and then that obviously then says, which is obviously why it gets clicks, because people say that, say, well, all these other studies over several years, decades, have shown this, but But this one study, which is an observation, has shown something different. So therefore, we got to discard all of that stuff before.
Yeah.
Because almost like that, as if that's all wrong now.
Yeah.
That's the way people think. People like to think in absolutes. It's either this or it's not. Yes.
Yes.
And that's not a way. That's not a good way of thinking about it. You can't think in black and white. You can't think in absolutes. What they say in Star Wars, only a Sith would think in absolutes. You have to be on the dark side to do that.
I haven't heard that one. Yeah, it's something that I'm dealing with all the time, is helping my clients get out of all or nothing thinking and black and white thinking when it comes to nutrition. And it is it's diet culture and the media that kind of perpetuate that black and white thinking.
Yeah, but it's also the medical community that as well, because the medical community are taught in a way that there's treatment, there's a placebo. Mm. So you see, it either works or it doesn't work. And they think of things in terms of this is the problem, this is the cure, or this is the treatment. But food is not a drug. They don't understand how to run nutrition studies. They think it's just a case of, you pop in a pill or not, or pop in a placebo. Yeah, it's incredibly difficult to do nutrition research, which is why, even though you've got RCTs and meta-analysis, you need to look at all of that evidence together, but also have an understanding of the machinery behind all of that to get an idea of what's going on, which a lot of people don't know, including medics. They don't have that understanding of the mechanisms that underpin it. Yeah, their knowledge of biochemistry is very end-user level rather than sort of investigator level. Yeah, so they understand it because they can see, that's why that drug works, because it does X, Y, Z. But they don't necessarily understand the intricacies of how all this stuff operates.
Mm.
And what happens when you obviously nutrition and interaction of nutrition, diet, food, is incredibly nuanced, like I said.
Well, it's complex just in the variable of nutrition, but then when you're also adding in the thousands of variables that each individual involved in the study would have experienced over their entire lives, their lifestyles, the genetics, all sorts. It's very hard to get precise with that.
Especially at an individual level. I mean, it's great that you can look at that in big populations. And of course, this is the big sexy thing at the moment, that obviously this precision nutrition, personalized nutrition, is all based on epidemiology. It's based on like big data that says, okay, this is what you see in a population. So therefore I'm going to decipher and diagnose you as an individual based on that, which of course is particularly when you're looking at people within a normal range. How can you tell? Just because it's different from that population that you've dated, that you've got, doesn't mean that that person as an individual is diagnosed in this way or the other. But anyway, that's a different matter.
It's a problem, sure. Well, I think that one size fits all approach is part of the, it's an issue in what you're describing, but also in the people that I help. They're told you have to do this specific workout. You have to just cut out carbs and hope for the best. And really what actually works is just finding what works for the individual and what fits into their life. I really want to talk about what you just said. You said in relation to there's years worth of studies and research on time-restricted eating, and potentially people are now going to disregard all of that because of this headline. Could you just summarize what you go into a bit more detail about the years of research on time-restricted eating and intermittent fasting?
Well, it's actually quite timely, isn't it, to talk about it at the moment, because Ramadan's going on, and that is time-restricted eating. And so that's going back millennia. So people have been doing time-restricted eating as a mode for a long time. So, observations of Ramadan have obviously been part of that story. But There's different tranches of science that have looked at time-restricted feeding. So you can think of it from an intermittent fasting perspective. So that is a form of intermittent fasting, and the rationale behind that has been quite well established now over the last 10, 20 years. But obviously it goes back before that because of things that have been observed prior. And then, of course, you've got the chronobiology circadian aspect as well, which is also another element of time-restricted eating, that chrononutrition, which is sort of overlapping. And there's a debate that actually we've had here because we've got a very strong sleep and chronobiology team as well as nutrition. And is it because you're changing the timing? Was it to do with a circadian effect or chronobiology effect? Or is it because you're extending the fast? Or is it a metabolic effect? And the answer is it's probably a combination of the two. And that's obviously illustrated when you start looking at differences between, say, early time-restricted feeding and late time-restricted feeding, or possibly Ramadan versus your modern time-restricted eating, because obviously it's happening at completely different times of that 24-hour cycle. The science is there. It's been there for a long time. And I think this is what people forget, is that when they do like a PubMed search and they start to look at things, they only confine themselves to looking at time-restricted eating. Oh, well, there's only been 10 years of research on time-restricted eating. But they forget that there's like 50 years of research prior to that around all the things we understand which underpin and rationalize what the effect of time-restricted eating is. Again, unless you have been immersed in that or know that, then you wouldn't appreciate that. So if you're coming in cold and just looking at it at one point in time or looking at one study, then you just lose all of that context altogether. So that, I think that would be the message to take, is not just the fact that we've got specific research going back several years, maybe even more than a decade, on time-restricted eating itself, but that ignores the wider research that we've got over a longer period of time on all these things that underpin it.
Because at the end of the day, all we're talking about here, we're not talking about extended fasts, 72 hours and beyond. We're talking about extending your overnight fast by a few hours.
Yeah.
If you look at it in terms of evolution, your understanding of this aspect, do you think we would have got to this stage in human evolution if we were that fragile?
No. I mean, we are incredibly robust. That's the whole point. I mean, we are designed to be feeding and foraging and then resting and digesting. You know, we are designed to maybe invest energy at times to do that feeding and foraging. You know, so you're a hunter-gatherer type lifestyle, you're going out and either hunting that food or farming that food, and then you're eating that food. And you're doing that intermittently. And your body's very well adept at doing that because it's got a way in which it can reserve energy and manage those energy reserves in a way that is going to satisfy what you need. And that, whether that's through a combination of your carbohydrate stores, which I know are finite and limited, but also your fat stores and how you're managing those two things, as well as all the other things that are going on, keeping the supply lines going, keeping everything in homeostasis, which is essentially your body's primary concern. To say that, you know, we are incredibly robust, but in a way that robustness is what conspires against us to some extent. And I'm not that simplified in the sense that, you know, we are all hunter-gatherers and therefore we're just all designed to be obese.
No.
If we just eat all the time, that's too simplistic an argument, because you've got, you know, that's just saying that your response is fixed back from when you're in the Stone Age. which is not true, because obviously you've got epigenetic nutrigenomic effects of exposure. You know, so your genome is designed to flex and adapt to what you're doing. But fundamentally, the design as a system is such that you're not designed. It would be a massive flaw if your system was designed to have a constant drip feed of energy all the time. Equally, it would be a flawed design if it was trying to go as long as it possibly can without any supply of fuel altogether. So it's designed to be able to take advantage when you've got the supply and adapt to when you don't, because that's the way it's designed. You've got like a backup and a primary system that is in play all the time. The problem you've got is that everybody's using their primary system because they never have to tap in to their backup system, because you're even never in a situation where you have to rely on it, because you're oversupplying all the time. You're awash with your primary substrate, or you're not demanding enough fuel overall, because you're basically sedentary, or you're not actually causing your muscles to demand anything or expend anything. It's that sort of abuse of the system rather than a flaw in the system itself.
And really, I think the reason why time-restricted eating has become so popular is because it kind of counteracts the modern lifestyle. Like, I'm 34. I remember 20 years ago, snacking in between meals was frowned upon. You know, you wouldn't snack because it would ruin your appetite for your main meal. Fast forward to now, it's normal to eat 12 times in a day. Snacking has become completely normal. And actually, as has sitting down all day, only getting 2,000 steps in, sitting at your desk all day. So time-restricted eating can be a great way to reinvigorate your body to function how it should and be more metabolically flexible. And as you described, use your secondary fuel sources, which is completely normal.
Yeah. I mean, we've been ingrained with this culture now where we can't, it's like people are scared to go for more than like 2 hours without having something to eat or drink. Now, part of that is down to the environment, of course, but I think part of it's also down to some duff advice, because I think
marketing.
Because I think people was sort of saying that, well, if you do go for long periods without eating, then you're just going to overeat on that meal. You won't be able to regulate your appetite. So little and often is maybe better to sort of stave off that hunger and stop you overeating overall. But it's totally backfired, because now we've got a culture of, like you say, snacking. It's not, and crazy. people don't think of it as snacks, though. You know, well, actually, people think everything is a snack, and people don't even think of things as meals. They even think of their meals as snacks. Yeah, so it's just it's just opportunity to eat all the time.
You're bang on.
It is that time-restricted eating is a way of bringing back some regiment in that way of eating. And, you know, like you say, it's in training you to some extent to recognize hunger in its truest form and eat to your appetites and those types of things. But it's a way of, like you say, resetting eating behavior to some extent. And combating this culture where you're constantly got stuff that you can eat on the go, whether it's like a Starbucks here or a vending machine there, or a all-night garage, which, you know, back in the day, you know, you didn't, the petrol stations maybe used to serve, you know, packets of crisps or bar chocolate, but now you can get all manner of food. You can almost like sit and have another meal in your petrol station now. And of course, drinks. People forget about drinks. So they'll talk about solid food. But a lot of these drinks are obviously giving you energy in the form of carbohydrate as well. So that all adds to the mix too.
Yeah, I mean, I can't describe how many of the people that I speak to and have spoken to just are exactly how you describe, no structure at all, aren't really having proper meals and are eating regularly throughout the day, and then wonder why they find it difficult to lose weight. And really the advice I give them is incredibly simple. It's eat proper meals, eat until you're full at those meals, and try not to snack in between those meals as much as you can. And then eventually, once they've done that for a period of time, experiment with maybe extending their overnight fast. And that the ones that do that consistently, they lose weight, they're not hungry, they're full of energy, they're still eating the foods that they enjoy, and it changes their lives.
Yeah.
So this has been a great discussion. I mean, is there anything else you think is worth saying that hasn't been said?
I think we talked a lot of things there, so yeah, maybe that's something for you to edit down into something that is useful for you. but yeah, I think we've covered the basis. I suppose, Roy, we've had this discussion when we were in communication before, and that is that for me, when people look at, and this study is a case in point, you know, people look at something in isolation and they think, well, that is now going to rewrite history, and everything else that's gone before it is defunct. Whereas what people don't have, and it's a skill that doesn't come to the majority of people, is you need to be able to interpret that evidence properly, not just in terms of being able to critically appraise the evidence that you're seeing in front of you, but also have the context to where that fits with the understanding of everything else that goes around it and what's come before. And that's what people don't have. And that's the dangerous precedent that you have when you've got people that are a bit ignorant or naive that are then amplifying these things beyond their worth. I think that's the thing that I find frustrating. Or cherry
press and the media specifically.
But it's not just the press and media. It's also some health professionals do that. I said people that are using that as part of the ammunition on their own platform, or to fuel their own argument,
their own beliefs.
Yeah. And it's tricky because it's, and I'm not blaming anybody to do it, because these things are incredibly complicated to understand. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that, you know, these people are doing something bad. It's just the fact they don't understand, because it's very difficult to understand. And that's why I want to try, and I'm in the process of trying to write a bloody book to try and explain a lot of these things to the public, or at least an educated population, because I think some of these things are misunderstood or not fully understood. And I think that helps, if you understand that, it helps you understand lots of things that are around at the moment. But what you've got at the moment is people don't understand the underpinnings of these things, so they just look at them on face value or look at them superficially. And even some of the metabolism and the sexy things that, you know, in terms of the detail, they might throw that at you. But again, they don't fully understand that. So they can come up with a mechanism or a pathway or a proteomic effect or a genetic effect, which all sounds very convincing and very high powered. But again, what's the context of that? You need to look at that in context, which is what people don't necessarily do. So, yeah, that's my charge, really. That's my campaign to try and do that.
Can you tell us any more about this book? Is there a time scale on it?
Well, I'm trying to get it published, basically. So I've got a proposal together. It's gone out and I've come back again. It's not been picked up yet, but I'm hoping it will, once I've adjusted it a little bit, will be of interest to someone. But it's a tricky one. And I don't criticise the fact that it hasn't been snapped up, because it's pitched at a difficult middle ground, because you're trying to sort of pitch a book that is robust and detailed enough to explain a lot of these things that are complicated, but yet is doing that to a mass market. So it's sort of trying to bridge those two fields, really. So yeah, it's a challenge, but we need to. I think it's a necessary thing that needs to be out there. Not because I want to sell lots of copies, but even if it sells, even if a few key people find it useful, then it's achieved its goal, really.
Well, it's the kind of thing that ideally these journalists would read before sharing clickbait articles like this with no understanding of what they're doing.
You'd hope so, but who knows? But yeah.
All right. Great. Thank you very much for that, Adam. What I can do is, if you keep me in touch with that book and what's going on with that, whenever it is out, I can obviously share the book with my audience and anyone listening to this. It can be linked underneath this recording. Is there anywhere else that is worth, if they want to find more information about you, Adam, is there anywhere else that people can be sent to?
They can come to even my university profile is up there, so people can contact me through that or through LinkedIn is another way. I mean, I'm old school. I don't really do social media. I don't have a presence on social media, much to my downfall, but people can still come get in contact with me, and I'm always open to discussions and working with people that have an interest.
Excellent. Well, thanks very much for your time, Adam, and we'll leave that there.